On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Robin Leach with those champagne wishes and caviar dreams, and you're listening to Good Food right here on KCRW.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every guy I see. Hey, big spender. Spend a little time with me.
My theory has always been, at least with the restaurants and with a lot of the shops and things, that there's this period in Las Vegas where money doesn't exist as money. It exists as kind of a liquid, right? You've been moving all these figures around and suddenly $4,000 doesn't seem like $4,000 anymore, and like $400 for dinner seems somehow reasonable because you were just betting $500. And there are all these restaurants and these shops and these establishments that sort of exist to get some of this money when it's still in a gaseous state before it like cools and becomes money again.
Las Vegas. Love it or hate it, it's a monster that commands attention, and it got ours. I spent 3 days there last week with Jonathan Gold and my producer, Jillian Ferguson. We ate our way down the strip and through the sprawl that surrounds the city. Today, we bring you part one of our Vegas report, What Happens in Vegas, The Strip. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Look, we're the luckiest people in the world living in Vegas. That's all I can tell you.
Robin Leach, the man who truly needs no introduction. For years, he sent us champagne wishes and caviar dreams as the host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Leach has lived in Sin City for 14 years. I caught up with him at Joelle Robuchon's atelier to find out how the dining scene here has changed over the years.
I've seen it go from shrimp cocktails at 50 for $1.99. to now where you have the Pope of cuisine, Joelle Robuchon. You know, when I first came here to Las Vegas as a visitor before I lived here, the hotel tycoons had secret dining rooms hidden behind libraries. And you would go into an innocuous room and you would know that you had to pull out a special book from the library case. And voila, the wall would open and there would be a four-star French restaurant. But we didn't have Italian restaurants. We only had four-star French restaurants in the hotels. The Italian restaurants that were here were really what we would call mom-and-pop family Italian food, like Piero's, which is probably the one restaurant in the world where more deals have been done than any other, including Wall Street. Deals that involve real estate, gaming, hotel acquisition, and a thousand other things.
So what is the equivalent of that today?
Well, there's no hidden restaurants any longer. There's no need. But the tycoons, you know, the Steve Wynns and the Sheldon Adelsons and then the corporate giants like MGM, Caesars, and who else is there? That's it. And then the independents like the Tropicana and a couple of others downtown, they own all the restaurants. They've done business deals with the superstar chefs. But I can assure you that unlike the hotels at this moment, hotels in Vegas do not make money anymore like they used to because all the money is made in Macau. But I can assure you that all the chefs are doing very, very well. Thank you very much.
The Vegas of my childhood was full of low-rise motels, lounge acts, cheap steak, and all-you-can-eat shrimp cocktail. When it came to food, it was continental blah. That is, until Wolfgang Puck showed up. 21 years ago, he opened Spago at the Forum, next to Caesar's Palace. He now has 6 restaurants on the Strip, but he admits that Vegas was a tough sell.
We were talking with Sheldon Gordon. He was the developer of the Forum. He wanted me to go to Vegas. I said, no, Vegas is crazy. There's all this free food already, and the buffets, you know, where you get at that time for $9.95 as much as you can eat, you know. I said, how can we open a restaurant? And he said, no, you should open a restaurant. And then finally I said, you know what? In Las Vegas, there are a lot of people who live there, who work there, and they might enjoy a nice restaurant. So we decided to open Spago at the Forum in Las Vegas, right next to Caesar's Palace. So we hired employees. We hired, I don't know how many, 120 people to work there. We opened in beginning of December. We got a great review from the Las Vegas newspaper. And then that day, 60 people reserved. So mind you, we had 180 seats in a restaurant. I had 9 waiter stations. I had 9 waiters, a few supervisors and the sommelier, and probably 9 or 10 busboys and the coffee guy and the chefs in the kitchen. And I said, oh my God, this was the biggest mistake of my life, opening in Las Vegas. There's nobody here. A week later, still no saying, I had to get drunk every night to fall asleep in front of my TV on the couch, woke up with a bad headache every morning, and said, oh, now I have to go back to Spago at Caesar's Palace. And then a week later, all of a sudden, I see all these cowboys walking around. So I had no idea that they had their rodeo show there. So they used to come up, we have an open kitchen, they used to come up and says, do you have any ribs or a burger? I just look at them, I say, what? We are in Oklahoma or in Texas here, it's crazy. By New Year's, all hell broke loose. It got so busy. On the 4th of January, we are normally in LA, it's slow. They have this a consumer electronics show there. And so we had a line out the door. I remember I arrived there the second day of the electronic show because they said, you have to come, this is crazy. I said, I want to see that. There was no cell phone at that time where they could send you pictures. So I flew the next day, I go there, and sure enough, we had people lining out outside into the Forum, and all I told the chef, I said, make pizzas as fast as you can, as many as you can. And I was personally serving all the people who were standing in line, pizza slices, and passing around champagne and red wine. And since then, we have never looked back.
This idea of having restaurants inside the hotels is a no-brainer, right? It keeps the clientele inside the casino, and they never have to spend their money anywhere else. But what if all the restaurants surrounding the casino floor were really good restaurants? What if high-end, fine dining was the entertainment? Here's Elizabeth Blau.
The massive catalyst and what got the ball rolling was really Steve Wynn's Bellagio. And Bellagio was the first time on such a scale, from Grant McPherson, the executive chef of the hotel, to Jean-Philippe Moret, who was the executive pastry chef. Really, you know, that set the bar. And then, of course, all of the celebrity chefs that followed.
If you've eaten well in Vegas, you have Elizabeth Blau to thank. She was responsible for bringing Le Cirque to Vegas, and she created the lineup at the Bellagio. Her consulting firm, Blau & Associates, is a strategic restaurant planning and development company. They work with properties all over the world. Plus, she and her husband have a couple of places of their own. Say her name in Vegas food circles and watch as people's faces light up.
Well, that's really nice to hear. You know, it's Las Vegas has been my home for 16 years, so I really consider it that, and I think that our food and beverage community is quite extraordinary here.
When you were first conceiving of this idea at the Bellagio and working on it, was it a hard sell to get chefs to understand what they could achieve here?
Well, it was really Steve Wynn who had this conception of what Bellagio was going to be. I was actually working for the Maccioni family in New York and spent a year negotiating the deal to bring Le Cirque and Circo, which were going to be the only outside restaurants, to Bellagio. So it wasn't so much as the idea was conceived as the idea evolved when we realized the magnitude of how extraordinary this resort property was going to be. Bellagio was a game changer for the city. And so really we attacked it one outlet at a time. When we look back to what's now Olive's, Todd English's wonderful restaurant, on the drawings it was marked retail cafe, but it was, you know, wedged in between Hermes and Prada. And so that was really the first one that we approached Mr. Wynn and said, you know, hey, this is, you know, it's not in the hotel. Why don't we think about, you know, doing another operator? And it just kind of snowballed from there to Michael Mina and Julian Serrano, Jean-Georges Vongerichten and Carrie Simon, things like the deal with Nancy Silverton to do an in-house bakery, because we had no bakery in the city on that kind of magnitude to produce at the level we would need for the cafe in the front of the hotel and the what would be considered, you know, the lounge area. We made a deal with Petrosian Caviar, and that became the Petrosian Bar. And all of those, you know, outlets are still here. So 15 years later, it's like, yay.
I mean, the talent there must be in this city and the hospitality industry, every part of the hospitality industry, must really be just simmering below the surface to make those independent restaurants like yours start to explode at a different rate now.
Well, having had restaurants in New York and in L.A., I can tell you there's a difference in the service culture from both the front and back of the house level here in Las Vegas. We have people who are career professionals. They are service industry professionals, whether they're culinary, whether they're front of the house service staff. But unlike other cities where, you know, in New York we had people that were in law school or poets or struggling actors, certainly in Los Angeles, half of our team were either struggling actors or models. These are career professionals, and this is what they're doing and what their chosen profession. And we've got UNLV, and we've got the community college, which has, you know, a great hospitality and great culinary programs. UNLV Hotel School is one of the best in the country. And so people come out of these, you know, schools, and they're really dedicated to our profession.
How much of the clientele at these properties throughout the city are patronized by locals?
Every property really makes a concerted effort to court the locals. If you ignore the locals, you're going to really have an issue during those, you know, even though there are only a few shoulder seasons. But they do exist in December and, you know, and in between holidays and certainly in the summer. And so really every hotel property works to court the local population. And what's exciting now is the proliferation of wonderful restaurants that have moved off the Strip. So you don't just have to go down to the Strip for an extraordinary dining experience.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for spending time with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me, and thank you for coming to visit our city.
That was Elizabeth Blau. Her consulting firm, Blau & Associates, is a strategic restaurant planning and development company. Blau and her husband also have three restaurants of their own: Buddy V's at the Venetian, Simon at Palms Place, and Honey Salt off the Strip in Summerlin. Coming up, vegan in Vegas? We'll talk to the LA chef who brought plant-based dining to the Strip.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
You're listening to What Happens in Vegas, part one of Good Food's Las Vegas special on KCRW. Let's face it, Vegas is a steakhouse town. Diners want meat and potatoes. I mean, filet mignon is the most popular steak sold on the Strip. So what happens when a top hotelier goes vegan? Well, I guess his restaurants just have to follow suit. 3 years ago, Tal Ronan, now chef and owner at Crossroads here in L.A., was tasked with introducing plant-based menus to all 22 restaurants at both the Wynn and the Encore. Tal, I'm so curious to know how you became the guy that first started working with the chefs up there to create
vegan menus?
It's a fun story. You know, I was introduced to Mr. Nguyen by a mutual friend, Dr. Dean Ornish. And if you don't know Dean, he's one of the first guys that reverse heart disease strictly through diet. You know, no pills, no surgery, just a great guy and good friend. And he suggested to Mr. Nguyen that I come in and cook for him because he wanted to roll out plant-based menus, vegan menus, whatever you want to call it, throughout the property at Encore and at the Nguyen.
So what was it like working with the chefs? I would imagine you approach someone like Paul Bartolotta at Spiaggia, who is famous for his unbelievably insane sourcing of fish from
the Langoustines that he flies from halfway across the world.
Yeah, things that he flies in from halfway across the world. And so did it come down as like a mandate from Nguyen saying every
it
restaurant?
It was absolutely a mandate. You know, it was interesting. The first time I cooked for him was at Alex Strada's restaurant, Alex. And it was the only Michelin star rated restaurant on property. The most beautiful kitchen I've ever cooked in. And cooked for Mr. Nguyen, and he really loved the food. He saw that it was different than, you know, just vegetables that have been served to him, and that we could address protein through various ways, you know, grains, lentils, beans. And he said, let's do this everywhere on property. And it was interesting because the first restaurant was Lakeside, which is a seafood restaurant run by really great chef who also runs the steakhouse. And so those were the two that I had to work with first. And all the menus that I was going to create were going to have to reflect the vision of the chef that was there and the style of cuisine that they cook. So David Waltzog at Lakeside is known for seafood. So I was thinking to myself, how the heck are we going to do a vegan seafood menu? I'd put a little bit of time into thinking about it, but there wasn't a lot of time before, so it was really driven by what they had on hand. And the chefs really appreciated that because we weren't going to start sourcing crazy ingredients and really making their lives miserable. And, you know, I was very clear that I wasn't there to teach them how to cook. They're amazing chefs. A lot of them I've looked up to for a long time. We had fun. We went into the walk-in at Lakeside, and we saw these beautiful hearts of palm from Hawaii that were the size of my arm, and they were rock hard. And I had the idea of braising them with kombu to give it a seafood flavor. And when they were soft enough, we put them in a robo-coupe and pulsed it, and we got what looked like lump crab meat. And we took that, and we made vegan crab cakes. And they've just been a hit for almost 3 years now at Lakeside. You know, once you add the Old Bay seasoning and everything else, you really get that sort of flavor.
What was your toughest sell, either because the chef was very resistant or the food was the most challenging?
I thought that the seafood restaurant would be. You know, when you get to Asian dining and things like that, it gets easier, but I remember working with Red 8, which was the Asian restaurant there. It was a Chinese restaurant. And I knew how to roll one style of dim sum. That's it. And so I thought it'd be fun to have a vegan dim sum on the menu. And I made it. And I think it was watercress and shiitakes and the dumpling. And Mr. Nguyen would start following me to try the food at the restaurants that I had finished at. And he had it and loved it and ordered another one. And I was the one rolling them, hand rolling them, and he's ordering them. So I'm rolling them to order, and I'm thinking to myself, this is going to be impossible. And when I was done, the chef said to me, he's no longer at Red 8. We have a dim sum kitchen. And I just laughed. I went downstairs, and they had this beautiful kitchen where there was a whole team rolling every kind of dim sum you can imagine.
How fun.
Yeah, it was really cool.
And going through this whole process, you must have learned as much as you, like, gave. I mean, your takeaway
from— You're so right. And I was just going to say that the takeaway from all of this was I got to work with the world's best chefs. Mr. Nguyen has this great saying that, you know, the restaurants there, it's one thing to have a celebrity name tied into a restaurant, but to actually have the chef there to cook for you is far more important. So all the chefs on property at the Wynn actually are there every night, unlike the other hotels in Vegas where there's a celebrity chef that might come in once a year. It was really incredible.
So how long ago did this start?
3 years ago.
3 years ago. And and where is the program now in terms of, I mean, in Vegas, they keep track of everything so much.
Yeah,
in terms of the sales.
It's going great. One thing we did about a year and a half ago is we changed the menu to say, it used to say vegan menu. So when you were seated at any one of the restaurants, and there's 12 fine dining restaurants and over 20 other or 20 total restaurants, you'd be handed the regular menu, the vegan menu, and the wine list. Now, a lot of people coming from the Midwest or Texas probably would just ignore the vegan menu. So we changed it about a year and a half ago to the vegetarian menu. And it was still vegan, but we saw sales really increase just by taking that word vegan away.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Tal Ronan is the chef at Crossroads in Los Angeles. We've been talking about how he created plant-based menus for 22 restaurants at both the Wynn and the Encore in Vegas. It is not possible to talk about Vegas without diving into the buffet. Much like the city itself, the buffets seem to be polarizing. You either love them or you hate them. So when I found out that LA-based chef Chris Yembangrun of Night Market is a big fan, I knew I had to ask him why.
To me, it's sort of, I don't know, I guess like an escapist thing. You know, I'm in Vegas. I don't gamble. I'm not, you know, doing drugs or going to strip clubs or whatever. It's like the one place where I could sort of do something that seems kind of irresponsible and sort of disgusting in a way or decadent is going to a buffet.
You sent me these pictures of your most recent buffet experience in Las Vegas, and I looked at a couple of the plates, which had like ravioli sitting next to shrimp cocktail deconstructed on the plate, and then off to the side was a little bit of salmon, and then there was another plate that had, it was a plate, not little bowls, that had three salad dressings just poured on the plate. So I look at this and I think to myself, total nightmare. My stomach just shuts down immediately. What is it about the buffet that is so appealing to you? Is it the quantity?
Yeah, I think about that myself. You know, like, why do I crave this so much? Or, you know, and I feel that part of it might be that, you know, what I try to do every day at my restaurant is sort of hone in or do something kind of specific or like follow a certain thread, you know, and with buffets, it's not really one type of food. It's just sort of, it's buffet food. And, there's a real sort of strategy that you can observe. You know, if you sit there, you try to sit there for a couple hours or something, you know, so you can pace yourself, you know, because you don't want to be in and out in 30 minutes and then you're, you know, hungry 15 minutes after you leave. So I'll usually stay there for a while and you sort of watch people. And the thing that everybody does is they line up for this, the most sort of premium item, you know, and in this case, it's usually like king crab legs or something. I'm probably the only person who goes straight for like the refried beans or like, you know, the sort of taco station or the salad bar or something, which is, you know, not really expensive stuff, but it's stuff that I enjoy. Though it might sound hokey, it's like I feel like there's a way to approach buffets that's a little more soulful than approaching it like a, you know, like an accountant where you're trying to get every penny's worth of your $60 or $30 or whatever you pay for it, you know.
But for probably 99% of buffet goers, the accounting approach is what has them queuing up for crab legs. In fact, there's probably a line forming for them right now at the Wicked Spoon. Connoisseurs of the all-you-can-eat experience tell me that the Wicked Spoon inside the Cosmopolitan Hotel is the buffet to end all buffets. So that's where I met chef de cuisine Mark Crane for a tour.
Hi, we're excited to have you guys here.
So when I imagine a buffet, an a Vegas buffet, I imagine a huge table laden with stuff that sits out for a long time. I gather that I'm about to have a very different kind of experience.
Well, that's the anti-buffet, yeah. What we try to do is fresh food, small portions, just keep turning it over, keep making it fresh.
Okay, so let's go.
So right now, we're at the salad station. We try to focus on seasonality, colors, different textures, and interesting food types, basically, to make somebody interested to be able to go around the whole station.
The salad station alone was endless. Greek salad, wedge salad, niçoise salad, fruit salad, the obligatory kale salad, and then we got to breakfast.
We do two different kinds of Benedicts. We do a hot smoked salmon Benedict, which is from Santa Barbara Smokehouse, a really good product. And then we do a braised beef Benedict on the other side. We also have kind of scrambled eggs with cheddar cheese. And then we do red velvet pancakes and also cinnamon Pullman French toast.
And we're not talking about a chafing dish filled with pancakes or a chafing dish filled with scrambled eggs. It's set up so you have a cook line 3 feet from the buffet, and so they're just constantly making. It's really amazing.
Well, the thing with the Eggs Benedict, you want to have it fresh. If it sits, it's no good. So we play to the limit sometimes because we are doing it, and sometimes people will wait that extra 1 minute or so, but I feel definitely that it's worth it, you know, because it's fresh.
I have to say that walking through the Wicked Spoon Buffet is not unlike walking through the gaming floor of the casino downstairs. Everywhere you look, there's something to grab your attention, a new flavor, a new color, a new product, all vying for your eyes.
We have kind of brunch items out at this time. So we have the sausage patties, chicken apple sausage, regular bacon, Angry Mac and cheese, Merguez sausage, which is made downstairs, homemade Italian sausage. We've just got a new pork loin, which we brine for 24 hours, slab bacon, tandoori chicken, bone marrow, which comes out at 11, culottes of beef, deep fried chicken, wicked chicken, collard greens, mashed potato, curried rice, mussels, marinara, mussels, white wine, garlic, pizzas, paninis, and breads. So we do a garlic bread, egg white scramble, which we have goat's cheese, tomato, and spinach, shrimp, which comes out head-on, Calbee ribs, pork belly, Chinese-style boiled peanuts, and we also just have duck wings. It's basically a salt cure with 5 spice and sugar, confit for a couple of hours, and we fry it, and then it gets hit with 2 sauces. That's just served on a small square plate, 2 per portion.
That's just astounding. So how many people come through on an average?
I think we average between, like, say, 1,000 and 1,500 people most of the time. The busiest I've seen, we've done 3,500 in one day.
Wow. Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure to get such an in-depth tour.
It was a pleasure to show you around. Thank you for your time.
Chef Mark Crane says that it takes 80 cooks, and an army of dishwashers to get through each day. If you want to see what we're talking about, not just hear about it, we have a ton of photos for you over on the Good Food blog, kcrw.com/goodfood. Now Jonathan Gold is here to kind of digest this idea of the buffet. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and one of my traveling companions in Las Vegas last week. Jonathan, I understand that you've been thinking quite deeply lately on the buffet.
I've been working on sort of a think piece for Lucky Peach about it, and my dad was a big connoisseur of the buffet. He loved a buffet. His idea of a great afternoon out was to go to, you know, a smorgasbord or an all-you-can-eat deli or a Mongolian barbecue or anything that involved multiple passes through lines.
Was it primarily motivated by the economy of the buffet?
Well, there's always the illusion that it's possible to beat the system in a buffet, that you may be defeated by everything else in life, but by having kids who can go 10 times through the buffet line, you have triumphed in some small but important way.
That's so interesting because it's sort of the same as people who think they can beat the casino.
It is. I think that's why buffets may be so very popular in Las Vegas.
I just imagine your parents coming to the buffet. How many kids were you?
There were 3 of us, 3 boys.
And you just plundered the place.
We did. I was at the buffet with you the other day, and I was going through being sort of judicious, taking a baked good here, taking interesting salad here, and going back to the table, and I just saw this apparition of my dad's, you know, sitting up in heaven and scowling at me because I passed up the smoked salmon, so I went back and got some.
I love the image of you walking back to the table with the smoked salmon hanging over the edge of the plate. Mm.
It was hanging over the edge, wasn't it?
You know, it's interesting because I have never really been able to embrace the buffet. I've always thought of myself as the person that they actually make a ton of money on because I have a hard time looking at it as just sort of this economic opportunity to get over on them.
I don't really look at it as an economic opportunity anymore, and I can't even tell you how long it's been since I've been to the Bunch of Lunch buffet at Shakey's. But I suppose if you're going to a buffet like this and you're paying a lot of money or you're paying a lot of money at the Caesars buffet, then you probably do want to maximize value in some weird way. So you do want to go back for seconds on the salmon. You do want to go back for seconds on the beef. And you feel that if you just get a, you know, a baked good and some fruit and maybe a kale salad that you're wasting money somehow.
So what was your takeaway from the Wicked Spoon Buffet?
It was definitely one of the most impressive buffets that I've seen. I mean, it was – again, if you were the kind of person who was going to go back multiple times in one visit, I mean, you could do – have the Southern breakfast and the Italian breakfast and the healthy salads and the Chinese food and feel as if you'd eaten for 10.
There's a conversation going on right now on my Facebook page about buffets. Love them? Hate them? Have a favorite menu item you can't live without? Search for me, Evan Kleinman, and click like.
A little less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and baby, satisfy me.
In a minute, a Dippin' Dots cocktail? One Vegas mixologist is transforming the cocktail scene in a very big way. Stick around.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food Special, What Happens in Vegas. Okay, I just did what your mother tells you never to do, which is eat something strange you've never seen before, handed to you by someone you don't know that well. And my mouth is filling up uncontrollably with saliva. I feel like if I don't keep swallowing, I'm going to be drooling. But I'm told that by drinking this really incredibly aromatic gulp verbena margarita, I can have a super tasting taste experience.
The cocktail itself is called the verbena. It's basically a play on a lemon verbena and ginger margarita. The garnish is what makes it kind of more incredible and out of the ordinary. It's something called a Szechuan flower or a buzz button. So what happens when you eat this little flower, it speeds up all of your salivary glands and makes you what's called a super taster. It has an alkaloid in it called spilanthol. So suddenly your whole tongue starts tingling. It's hard to even explain. Once you've done it, you know, and once you see someone's face light up, you know that it's kicked in. But then every sip after, you're starting to taste different things, and it really is, I think the best description would be a roller coaster for your taste buds. For about 5 minutes, you know, you're just tasting it up and down, and you're all over the place.
I don't think I've ever tasted salt so deliciously before. I think what's really dangerous is you're so concentrating on what's happening with your tongue that you're completely unaware of what the alcohol is doing to you, which may be the point of this. Marina Mercer is the mixologist behind this roller coaster taste experience. She's the mastermind for all cocktails at the Cosmopolitan property. Her verbena margarita is the most popular cocktail at the Chandelier Bar, and it's not even on the menu.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. Is the position you have an unusual one, or do all the large properties have one central mixologist?
It is an unusual position. Over the last couple years, I've had it for 4 years almost. You've definitely seen a different attention to the beverage industry in Las Vegas, and so larger properties are starting to create this. Previous to our opening, there was only one other property in Las Vegas that had a mixologist for the property.
Tell us a little bit about what that involves.
So basically, I design all of the recipes for all of our bar tops, also events, our pools. It's really given me the autonomy to be as creative as I'd like. We started the beverage production kitchen. We actually have a team of our own chefs that make our syrups. They make our purees. All of our fresh juices come out of there, garnishes, bitters. We're actually the largest scale program of this type in the entire world, just the amount of mass volume that we do.
It must be quite wonderful for the bartenders as well, because everything must be so much more consistent, given that it all comes out of a central kitchen.
Absolutely. So one of the biggest challenges with a program of this size is consistency, and that was something that was very near and dear to my heart upon opening. I kind of went all around the city to different properties and ordered. I tried to order one drink. Very easy drink. Negroni has three ingredients. You don't need fresh juices. You don't need anything. You just need those three ingredients. Each bar top I would go to, they would make it different. Even if I was in the same establishment, each bar would be a different glass, different ice, different garnish, and a different recipe and some different techniques. Some would shake, some would stir. And then some would give me, most bartenders would give me a really bad attitude for ordering this because it's something kind of outside of their comfort zone. So I took all of that intel and brought it back to the property and said, consistency is something I want in our property. Everywhere, I want you to be able to go and have the same fantastic cocktail. So we have something called the Hot 15. It's the 15 most commonly ordered cocktails in Las Vegas. So it's, you know, the Long Island iced teas, apple martinis, Negronis, and things like that. But I wanted to make sure every bar top you went, you had the same great experience. And each mixologist could explain the recipe and why we're doing the things we do. So consistency is a buzzword here.
So gin and tonic, not on that list?
Gin and tonic, not, just because it's two ingredients and we have a standard pour for consistency. And then we wanted to give our mixologists kind of a little bit of, you know, creative liberties for themselves to kind of engage in conversation. So if someone does order a gin and tonic, they're prompted to, you know, ask a preference of gin. It also gives them a teaching podium. If someone's like, you know what, I've never had anything else but Tanqueray, what do you have? We can go into, you know, our house gin is something called Ford's Gin. It's this new gin that, you know, just came out from this amazing, amazing line of spirits. And it has jasmine infused in it. So this is why it's going to pair better with tonic or soda and kind of cater the garnishes and things to the gin and tonic.
Wow, I just learned something. A friend of mine gifted me with Ford's Gin actually for my birthday, and I couldn't figure out what it was that made me love it more than any other gin on my little bar at home. Now I know. Do you ever just sit at a bar and when it's packed and listen to the conversation?
Absolutely. I'm such a people watcher. I think I like to be kind of a wallflower, and I love listening, and I find people and interactions fascinating. So my favorite thing is at a bar or a restaurant is to get like a back corner table or somewhere, you know, where I kind of blend in, which is hard for me to blend in. I am 6'1", you know, I kind of blend in the background and just kind of get intel that way. And there, I know it's not contrived. They're not saying something to get, you know, a reaction out of me because they have no idea I'm spying on them. So absolutely.
You must also get tons of feedback from bartenders. For example, have you ever had a spectacular failure in a cocktail?
I like to call them beautiful disasters, but yes. I think it's a lot of trial and error, and obviously doing something that is so different than anyone has ever done before. You fall on your face a lot. I've done a pizza-inspired cocktail. It was for a pizza cocktail competition. I actually got so literal in the translation that, like, I baked a bread crust around a martini glass and did, like, these caviar buffet of, like, onion water and olive water, and you just went very over the top. So I'm like, if I'm going to be kitschy, I'm going to be really, really kitschy. So obviously it tasted like drinking pizza, which there's a reason we don't drink pizza.
I love that. There's a reason we don't drink pizza. Okay, so I'm really intrigued by the pool and your knowledge of science. And I think about how people are making drinks cold these days. Are you playing with nitrogen, perchance?
actually, it's one of my favorite things to do. I get so excited about it. We have a boozy ice cream shop, and it's called Neapolitan. So everything is in different frozen formats. We have smoothies, shakes, popsicles, and liquid nitrogen sorbets. So liquid nitrogen sorbets, for instance, are made a la minute. So they actually, you know, put it all in the mixing bowl. They grab the liquid nitrogen, and it's in a KitchenAid mixer, and mix it up right there in front of you. And my mixologists have, like, bikinis and lab coats and cute little glasses and goggles. It's so inspired by novelty and kitsch, but I absolutely love it. We're going into our third year, and previous to that, no one had ever done that before. So now it's a lot of fun to see them start popping up around the country and, you know, people doing boozy ice creams and that kind of stuff. So it's really cool.
And what about the popsicles? Are they, like, in an Otter Pop form?
So I play around each year with formats. Last year, I was really big into the Dippin' Dots. So I actually had the syringes, and we made the little Dippin' Dots, like Banana Split and things every day, Neapolitan, the namesake. The popsicles are in different types of formats. This year, I'm looking at different, like, tubes and things like that. For the first 2 years, they were very, like, nostalgic, 1950s, like, mold.
Okay, we have to go back to the Dippin' Dots. What is the delivery system for the alcohol part?
So everything is batched into my different, so like, let's say for Banana Split, for instance. Each one of the flavors, I get very granular. So I'll take a banana. I think I was using banana schnapps, a banana puree. For vanilla, I was using a whipped cream vodka, vanilla syrup, and a little bit of cream. Strawberry, had a strawberry vodka, strawberry puree, and then chocolate, creme de cacao, and a little bit of cream. So each one is actually put in a different syringe, and I have a dewar of liquid nitrogen that I've poured out into kind of like an anti-griddle anti-dewar, and then just literally drop them all one by one, and as they hit the liquid nitrogen, they freeze into little balls.
Well, doesn't cause the alcohol to evaporate.
Absolutely. So it keeps it, it's completely as boozy as it started, which is fun.
Wow, that's like the best use of an anti-griddle I've ever heard. Thank you so much.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you.
Marina Mercer's the mixologist at large for the Cosmopolitan Hotel. We've got a photo of her verbena margarita garnished with that Szechuan flower on our blog. Check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, the ultimate luxury in Las Vegas is the dining room at Joël Robuchon. Jonathan Gold weighs in on the experience next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Good Food. You're listening to What Happens in Vegas, part one of our Las Vegas special.
I'm sitting in the restaurant Joël Robuchon here in Las Vegas with the man himself, Chef Robuchon. And after having dined here last night, which was a spectacular experience, you know, I have to say that after having dined in such an incredibly beautiful, quiet, curated way, and then having walked out into the casino floor where all you're assaulted by sound, light, sort of very popular sounding PA system announcements, I said to myself, how did they convince him to come here? At the very beginning, when you first came here to visit, when you were in discussion to do the restaurant, did they walk you through the casino floor? Did you understand that you were going to have to recreate the kind of beauty and very particular experience that you offer in Paris and other parts of the world in a corner of such chaos?
Oui, alors on a essayé de faire, c'est vrai, un restaurant qui est assez quand même, c'est vrai.
It is true, when we first opened the restaurant, we did feel a little isolated, like we were on our own island in the corner here at the MGM, but at the beginning, we had very few customers. We had 3-4 customers in a night sometimes, so it was very difficult at the onset. But what makes me very satisfied now is that we have such a large repeat clientele. Very many of our guests, many of whom come from Los Angeles, actually will fly out or drive out just to have dinner with us and then go back home. And what we see now is that we are full almost every single night, which gives me a lot of satisfaction.
You have the restaurants in Paris. You have, this is the only location in the U.S. You have a location in Macau. Do you tailor the experience to the location?
Oui, j'essaie de tenir compte quand même des endroits.
Yes, of course. With regard to the location, the geographic location of where we are at any given point in time, we have to look for the locality of produce, and we have to keep that in mind when we're building the recipes in each individual location. We have, for example, here wonderful farms that are around this area from where we get wonderful potatoes. Sea urchin even is of wonderful quality out here. So whenever I look at building a recipe tailored to that specific location, I do first look at the produce that's available.
I wonder if you would share with us a memory. I find that people who grow up in the food business seem to be pushed forward by a primal memory, something maybe they experienced in childhood that they come back to over and over again in their mind regarding food.
D'abord, je vais vous surprendre. Il faut que vous sachiez comment je suis rentré en cuisine.
To begin with, I probably have to tell you that, and it may come as a surprise to you, but I actually began in a seminary when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And at that point in time, we had a lot of time spent where we were not allowed to speak. We had to stay in study or in prayer. And so for me, the nuns were always looking for people who were willing to help out in the kitchen and help cooking. And when I say cooking, I mean in the very basic sense. We were mostly peeling vegetables or washing dishes. But for me, that was relaxation time, where I was able to step away from this quiet time at the seminary. And as you know, nuns are very much spiritual. And from that memory and that upbringing, I take away an extreme respect for the produce that we have. When you look at what we cook with on a daily basis, in many times you have to take a life in order to cook or prepare a dish for someone. And so what I do is I have enormous respect for this life and for the produce which I'm allowed and enabled to work with. And I take that really from my memories.
Thank you so much.
Merci beaucoup.
That was Chef Joël Robuchon. We've been sitting in the bar at Robuchon in Las Vegas. People may be surprised to hear it, but I have sort of held back from myself some of the peak culinary experiences that one would imagine that just as a matter of course, because I do what I do, I would have had several of. I'm talking about the very high-end, super uber culinary experience. But no, I have to say I was waiting to go with Jonathan and my lovely producer, Jillian, to Robuchon in Las Vegas. And even you, Jonathan, were shocked to learn that this was my first, like, sort of masterful culinary degustation experience.
You were chef for so long. I mean, I thought it inevitable that you would have ended up at Taille Avant in Paris, or at least, you know, a place like, you know, Danielle in New York.
I've leaned more towards the lower end of the scale. So for me, this experience was quite something. The fact that such a palace of dining exists in the corner of a casino, I still find unbelievably odd.
It's in the MGM, which is a very nice casino, but it's not what you think of as the opulent one. And you walk past all these slot machines with, like, pictures of Michael Jackson on them or fireballs or, you know, the usual kind of stuff. And then there's Robuchon.
Yeah, I mean, also, it's not a small casino. It's like being in a village. So basically, you enter the MGM Grand and you basically have to walk, like, the equivalent of a quarter mile, probably.
I'm not sure if it is now, but there was a point where that was the biggest hotel in the world.
Yeah, really huge. And then you basically walk to the very, very, very far corner, and there is the restaurant, Joël Robuchon. We should say that we didn't eat at the Atelier. We ate at the more
the more sort of restaurant.
I like the Atelier. I mean, I've been to the one in Paris several times. And even from the first time I ate there probably a dozen years ago, you realized that it was going to be the future of fine dining in the world, that in a way the world of small plates restaurants comes from what he was doing there. The idea that because the food was formal and exquisite didn't mean that the service had to be. But you might as well go the whole nine. And I'd had one of the just most glorious meals of my life at the Robuchon restaurant called Germain, which is I think his first three-star restaurant in Paris. It was – Ruth Dreischel paid for it. It was the honeymoon gift for my wife Lori and I.
A pretty great, wonderful gift.
It was really good. That was a tough reservation to get.
So 30 years later nearly.
Right.
We find ourselves in the corner of this casino, seated on tufted purple velvet couches. How did it match up to the one you had in Paris?
Everything is more formalized here and everything is sort of larger than life. There wasn't that sort of improvisatory idea that they're making it up as they go along. But of course, luxury is never quite like that, is it?
No. And I mean, for me, the experience, it was almost in two parts. There's the food and then there's the space. And from the minute you walk in, it's clear that you are being transported to a place of fantastic luxury.
Right. You would think there would be this thing of decompression from the casino, but there isn't. You're sort of in the casino and then boom, you're in this room with the plushness and with the soft classical music and with the people dressed up in a way that they never are anywhere else in Las Vegas. And with the sort of service that you just don't see anymore. It's not the, hey, Mac, it's not the beautiful woman, it's the French waiter who's been doing this clearly for his entire working life, who knows more about food and wine than anybody you've ever met, who is there to make you comfortable.
Yeah, and I was actually pretty surprised at how playful the service staff were at times.
They were trying really hard not to be intimidating, which is hard at a place like that.
Definitely. I mean, from the minute they wheel over the bread cart, maybe we could start there. Maybe you could describe the bread cart.
Well, first off, there is a bread cart. Secondly, the bread cart is just incredibly elaborate, this big sort of wooden thing with – it must have been 20 different kinds of breads. But I think what impressed all of us the most was when they brought out the butter. And they brought out the butter. It was like this giant Corinthian column of butter.
Yeah, it was a separate butter cart. Well, the butter and olive oil cart.
Yeah. And they carved off these beautiful thick curls of it.
And it was Brittany butter.
Yes, it was extremely good butter. I think actually any of us would have been happy to have just had bread and butter and skipped the rest of the meal. But of course, we weren't going to skip the rest of the meal because there were many, many courses to come.
How many courses were there?
I'm not remembering. There may have technically have been 15, though a lot of them were served to us in flights. So that there was a – and this was different for you because you got the – vegetarian menu, but there was like a flight of crustaceans, which included, you know, his famous langoustine ravioli with truffles. There was a little dish of sea urchin on mashed potatoes, but what mashed potatoes those were. One of the things I also noticed at Robuchon, which is something that I haven't seen in American menus in a really long time, is the sort of emphasis on super luxury ingredients. I mean, it's, you know, there was foie gras in four or five courses. There was caviar in at least four or five courses. There was gold leaf on things. There were langoustines, which are, you know, one of those top French ingredients. And there were truffles. I mean, literally paving that tart, you know, shaved over things like most places shave Parmesan.
I mean,
I quickly realized in my choice to have chosen the vegetarian option was that I was trading the caviar, the langoustines, and the foie gras for truffle.
Yeah, you got double truffles on everything.
Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary. Was the quality of the experience similar to what you experienced in Paris all those years ago?
I would say the food was extraordinarily detailed and really well plated and served. It doesn't knock my memory of that out. But, you know, that was in 1990, and there have been a lot of meals under the bridge since then. And sometimes you wonder if, like, some of the extraordinary meals that one experiences as, like, a younger person are so vivid because, you know, it's the fourth four-star meal you've ever had. I mean, when I went to, you know, Michel Garard for the first time, you know, I'd hitchhiked across France to get there. And it had better have been good, right? I mean, I'd been saving up for it for a year. Whereas, you know, this one, you're in a hotel. It's like, oh, what the hell? Let's go to this restaurant. You make the reservation and you're there and suddenly you're just in the middle of this thing.
I felt like we were in an island on an island.
That makes sense because one of my problems with Las Vegas cuisine is that there's sort of no there-ness to it. I mean, nothing reflects the terroir of Las Vegas because there is no terroir of Las Vegas, right? Nothing grows there. It has, in a certain respect, become the luxury restaurant district for Los Angeles. That in the way that if you want to eat a certain kind of food in New York, you know, to eat Thomas Keller food or to eat the extraordinary food of, you know, Masa Takeyama, that you go to the Time Warner Mall and you take the elevator up six floors and suddenly you're in Per Se. And Las Vegas is almost like that, right? You get in your car and 3 hours later you're in Las Vegas, where you're eating at Robuchon.
Really fascinating. A fascinating experience. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about our extravagant meal at Joël Robuchon in Las Vegas. You can see photos of it on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can find all of Good Food's episodes, including part two of our Las Vegas special, on demand on the KCRW app. This episode of Good Food first aired in March of last year. It was produced and edited by Jillian Ferguson and mixed by Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.